Well, I want to thank the members of the Progressive Christianity Discussion Group, which met last Wednesday, for giving me my sermon this morning. We were discussing a couple of chapters from Marcus Borb's book, Convictions. Marcus Borb died a couple of years ago, but this is the very last book he wrote just before he died. And those two chapters, I thought, were rather ho-hum. And I was thinking, we're not going to have very meaningful conversation about this. It's kind of a given. But was I wrong? Because the members of the group thought it was highly significant. In fact, they thought Borb's message was of huge importance to this church. So are there any people there that are part of that discussion group? Just kind of wave your hand. Three, four, five, okay. So when I finish my message today, it'd be very fun to just do a like open mic. If any of you would like to add comments or reflections, that would be great. Or anyone else that has a comment or reflection on the theme of this morning's message. We'll just take a few moments to hear from you. But one of the group members shared, many of us do the deeds of mercy and justice, but we really don't understand and appreciate the biblical and theological basis for why we do what we do. Well, Marcus Borb definitely helps us with that by directing us to the book of Amos in the Hebrew Bible. Marcus Borb came from a family of religious and political conservatives. As a sophomore in college, Borg became president of the Young Republican Club, and he was a columnist for the conservative political movement on campus. Then Borg took a philosophy course in his junior year where the students spent a whole week reading and discussing the Old Testament prophet Amos. It was a revelation to him. Amos led him to realize that the Bible had a dimension that he had never seen before. Amos was about God's passion, desire, dream, yearning for the transformation of this world toward greater economic justice. Borg became more and more convinced that what he saw and heard in Amos was actually central to the entire Bible and in the life and ministry of Jesus. It was one of the convictions that shaped his understanding of what it actually means to be Christian. In the chapter 8 of our book, Borg urges all Christians to do a multi-session study on Amos to begin to discover how the Bible, from beginning to end, is a sustained protest against the domination systems of the ancient world. So let's turn to Amos. The book of Amos is a collection of his oracles put into writing a generation or more after his death. So the whole process of putting those oracles into writing involved not only collecting them, but then arranging them and editing them. Amos spoke in the northern kingdom of Israel near the end of the long reign of King Jeroboam II, 786 to 746 BCE. So a little previous history. The kingdom of David and Solomon had divided into two at the end of Solomon's reign in the late 900s. The north, with its capital in Samaria, continued to be known as The northern kingdom, with its capital in Samaria, continued to be known as Israel. Very good. The south, with its capital in Jerusalem, was known as Judah. Boy, are you good. So the northern kingdom, Israel. The southern kingdom, Judah. The two kingdoms were often enemies with one another and at war. From that time in the 900s, we jump forward a couple hundred years to the time of Amos, who prophesied in a time when the wealth and power of the monarchy and the ruling class greatly increased, but the condition of most of the population deteriorated. So often in fierce language, Amos articulates a formidable social critique. He both indicts and judges the wealthy and the powerful, and he advocates for the cause of the poor. And Amos' strategy is brilliant. I urge you to read it. It was a discovery to us in our discussion group. Wow, we never read Amos. This is such cool stuff in Amos. But his strategy is this. His Israelite audience heard him pronouncing God's judgment on all their traditional enemies, including Damascus, Gaza, Tyre, Edom, Ammon, and Moab. And no doubt were excited to hear that God was judging all their enemies. But then Amos directs the indictment against them. Alas for those who sit on beds of ivory, you who lounge on your couches, and eat lambs from the flock and calves from the stall, you who sing idle songs to the sound of the harp and, like David, improvise on instruments of music, you who drink from bowls fine wine, and then anoint yourselves with the finest oils, but you are not even grieved over the ruin of the poor. Amos called the wives of the wealthy and the powerful in the capital city of Samaria sleek and fat cows. Hear this word, you cows of Bashan, who sit on Mount Samaria and continue to oppress the poor and crush the needy, who say to their husbands, "Bring me something else to drink." And then to all Israel, both men and women, Amos prophesies, "Thus says the Lord, for three transgressions of Israel," not the other foreign nations, but you, Israel, "for three transgressions of Israel, or for four, I will not revoke the punishment, because they sell the righteous for silver, sell the needy for a pair of sandals. They trample the head of the poor into the dust of the earth and push the afflicted out of the way." So notice here that the chosen people, Israel, Judah, the chosen ones are being treated here like everyone else. They are subject to the same requirements and marked for the very same judgments, without exception for any special exceptional status. Imagine an American preacher doing the very same thing, first kind of hooking his audience by indicting other nations for their injustice and their violence, perhaps Iran, North Korea, Cuba, China, Russia, but then indicting the United States for its violence, for its injustice. That's exactly what Amos did. Amos seems to be saying, you can't oppress the poor and the needy and get away with it. You will be judged. And judgment did indeed come to Israel with the onslaught of the Assyrians, who terminated the northern kingdom in 721 BCE. Well, eventually Marcus Borg came to see that Amos was not a solitary figure in the Bible, speaking against the powerful and violent ruling elites of the domination system. Borg saw the same courage in Moses, the prophets in general, in Jesus, and in Paul. Their passion was the transformation of the domination systems of this world into a world of fairness, where everyone has enough and no one's human rights are violated. So what we hear in Amos and in other major biblical voices challenges much in American politics and in Christianity. The U.S. has the greatest income inequality in the developed world and is the product of the political ideology of individualism. This is all from Borg. He's got a whole chapter on American individualism and American exceptionalism. So this ideology of individualism is the belief that how our lives turn out is largely the result of our own efforts as individuals. If our lives have turned out well, it's because we've kind of pulled ourselves up by our own bootstraps, we've worked hard, and we then deserve to keep everything we've earned. Unfortunately, this has a cruel corollary. If our lives haven't turned out so well, it's largely our own fault because we failed to make use of the opportunities provided us. So as an ideology, individualism is the foundation of conservative politics and economics. The political passion of conservatives is primarily about the behavior of individuals, especially issues related to sexuality. Income inequality, economic justice, and a strong commitment to peace rarely are priorities for most of them. I know that's a wide generalization, and you can contest that if you wish, but that's what I've observed. The alternative to individualism is a politics that takes seriously the common good. It's grounded in the realization that none of us actually is self-made. All of us sit on the shoulders of those who have come before us, and we benefit from their sacrifices and their humanitarian effort. None of us is self-made, however disciplined and responsible we might have been. We benefit from what previous generations did for the common good, including universal education, civil rights, gender equality, government-created infrastructure, and so forth. Well, in addition to this ideology of individualism, we find a second ideology affecting politics and Christianity in the United States. American exceptionalism. This is all from Borg, not from Kent. This is the notion that we are the greatest. We are the best. We are blessed of God. God bless America. But it's true, there's much to admire about our country. And there's nothing wrong with being grateful to live here. But as an ideology, American exceptionalism is more about hubris than about gratitude. Hubris is about puffing oneself up beyond appropriate size, whether as an individual or as a country. Our African American brothers and sisters have experienced the sharp sword of American exceptionalism. In his 2003 sermon entitled Confusing God and Government, Reverend Jeremiah Wright, then pastor of Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago, preached, "When it came to treating her citizens of African descent fairly, America failed. She put them in chains. The government put them on slave quarters, put them on auction blocks, put them in cotton fields, put them in inferior schools, put them in substandard housing, put them in scientific experiments, put them in the lowest paying jobs, put them outside the equal protection of the law, kept them out of the racist bastions of higher education, and locked them into positions of hopelessness and helplessness. The government gives them the drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a three-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, 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 not God Bless America, but God Damn America. That's in the Bible. God Damn America for killing innocent people. God Damn America for treating our citizens as less than human. God damn America as long as she tries to act like she is God, that she is supreme, and I would add that she is exceptional. The United States government has failed the vast majority of her citizens of African descent." You remember that sermon, don't you? We remember that Dr. Wright's Goddamn America sermon, as it came to be known, was used by political conservatives to question the patriotism of his parishioner Barack Obama during the 2004 presidential campaign. Well, back to Amos. Amos challenged and chastised the exceptionalism of his time. Many people, perhaps most in ancient Israel, believed that they'd been chosen by God. They were God's special, exceptional people. But American individualism and American exceptionalism are no different. And the two go together. So Amos and much of the Bible challenge both. We need Amos. And we need Dr. King, whose vision for guaranteeing the civil rights of African Americans extended more broadly to guaranteeing the value, worth, and human rights of all people, whom Dr. King referred to as the World House. What a visionary, seeing that not only my people and my tribe need to have their rights protected, but all people, everywhere, need to have their rights protected, because we are part of the World House. He also called us the beloved community. And despite some of his outrageous and offensive remarks over the years, we need modern prophets like Jeremiah Wright. Why do we in this church give such high priority to acts of mercy and justice? Because we follow in the train of ancient and modern prophets who inspire our witness and motivate us to be change agents in our world. Well, it was really important to last week's discussion group, and it's become more important to me this week, to help us as a congregation understand that the political issues of the Bible, which are also religious, are about economic justice and fairness, peace, and nonviolence. The youngest member of our discussion group shared how, as a teenager, he would come out to his peers as Christian. But he would quickly clarify, "I'm not Christian in the spirit and politics of the religious right." He shared how meaningful it is to him to have grown in his faith and understanding, to be able to define his Christianity not only by who he is not, but rather by who he is, a biblical Christian, whose political and religious issues are about economic justice and fairness, peace, and nonviolence. Some of us may be shy about identifying ourselves as Bible-believing, Christ-centered Christians because of how the religious right has co-opted such terms. So through this message and through the interaction of our discussion group this week, I'm hoping more of us gain confidence in declaring ourselves to be both Bible-believing and Christ-centered. The kind of Christian whose politics and religion is about building a more just, compassionate, and peaceful society above all else. Any comments? Any thoughts? Not a new discussion group. They wanted more Amos. You know, we finished our discussion and they said, "We need a study on Amos in this church."
Yeah, I just kind of thought it was interesting in just how I've had like a conversation with a friend before, and he's from kind of a very kind of conservative, kind of rich background, from like the Milwaukee suburbs, and so he's always had that kind of like sheltered view of how just how the world is. And I just remember the conversation he had where he was saying nowhere in the Bible does it talk about social justice. You don't see that anywhere in the Bible. And I was like, wow, that's a strong statement right there. And I was like, I remember going to talk to a guy that I know who's very, we like to have religious conversations about this stuff. And it's like, oh, that's a weird statement. I've never heard of that. And then we had a really strong talk about, the book of James and then just the stuff Jesus says and does. And it surprises me that people still think that.
Trump has only said one thing I agree with, and that is we should have more politics from the pulpit.
We should have more politics from the pulpit.
First, I like the sermon. Second, a critique. Or maybe it's a critique of Bork, I'm not sure. But I think both liberals and conservatives intertwine individual and collective. It's just that we do it in different ways, if you think about it.
Intertwine individualism and exceptionalism, or
individualism and common good. So, for example, the old arguments in favor of patriarchal family were common good arguments, that it's better for the family if women are subordinated. So, that's just one example.
Using the same terms, but with very different meanings. It was another hand.
I particularly resonated to the American exceptionalism idea. I have never believed that America is more exceptional than any other nation. We have too many warts, and we've had too many things that are totally inconsistent with the teaching of Christ.
One or two more?
First of all, Ken should have known that our group would find things to talk about, because if there's one thing we can do is talk. One of the most important, one of the real eye-openers I got as I was reading that was the idea that words from the prophets talking about a better way to live, they were talking about how people right here could do, among them could do better, as opposed to an afterlife, a heaven or something, or a idyllic kind of a utopian thing, all of which made those words ready to stir you up to go do something. I was going to use the word rabble-rousing. That sounds kind of crass, but that.
Yes, thanks, Jaron. In fact, there's a previous chapter in this book from Bork on salvation, and he makes a very strong point tracking the use of the word salvation from beginning of the Bible to the end, and how salvation was mostly about salvation in the here and now, about getting involved and making our own lives better, not only our own lives, but the lives of others, right here and now. Dan?
Well, two things really. One is that given that emphasis on individualism, it's not surprising that our nation would elect a supreme narcissist. And in the context of Amos, he was a prophet who was telling the northern kingdom, kind of got me confused because I knew it as Ephraim, but foretelling that they were about to fall. And the reason they're about to fall is that God was going to punish them for what they were doing. And in an era where people talk openly about the nuclear button, I think there's a lesson for us in that as well.
This is good stuff. I don't want to cut it off. Maybe one or two more? Are we?
Yes, Ken.
I think it's important to also not become what you're disliking. It's very easy to get upset about the people who are not thinking about the social justice side of the world. And I say to my kids all the time, life isn't fair. It isn't just. And one of the things that Jesus always did was find the tax collector, the person who wasn't necessarily accepted, even if they were not necessarily paying attention. So I think accepting of people willing to say, oh, I've messed up, I'm going to try again, I messed up. I'm going to try again. And trying to hammer home the other thing I thought of while I was listening to you. I don't know if you, the hymn Finlandia. I don't know if you have it on the program today. I've been busy chasing a kid. My country's skies are bluer than the ocean, and sunlit beams on clover leaf and pine. But other lands have sunlight too, and clover, and skies are everywhere as blue as mine. I think that's the message that we have to try to get to everybody, to keep reminding them that we keep doing the wrong thing. We don't see all the inequalities that exist, but we have to keep trying.
Thanks so much, friends. That was really good sharing. Let's join in our closing song.